Hello, everybody. I'm glad so many people came to this talk. This is actually the Movember edition, because as you might know, it's Movember. The main difference between the Movember edition and the default version is that I'm wearing a Mo. Okay. I'm a final year PhD student from TU Dresden. If you don't know where Dresden is, you take Berlin, and then there's Prague, and Dresden is somewhere in the middle, to give you a bit of a perspective. The group that I'm working in is mainly dealing with distributed systems. So teaching is not really a distributed system, so it's a bit of a different area of work that I did. Okay, so what is the problem? The problem that we are addressing in this paper is that everybody does backups, and in order to incentivize people to do backups more frequently, they should be fast and consume only few resources. For example, if you just take a normal hard disk drive that you can buy these days, which has a 4 terabyte of capacity, just reading through that 4 terabytes of data will take more than 6 hours. The problem that we are trying to solve here is, again, we want to do periodic state transfers, mainly from one machine to another, in order to do backups. The key point here is that we want to do it periodically, because if it's only a one-off copy, there's not much that we can really do to make the process more efficient. Okay. So my question to you, to get this a bit more interactive, is how do you do your backups? What kind of software do you need? Just can you just shout some of the tools that people are using? ZFS replication. What else? Exactly, rsync. Say again?
CP-L, you make copies with links.
Okay.
And then you are synchronized.
Also one option. So there's a couple more. All those people that have Macs probably use Time Machine. Then we already heard ZFS has this snapshot facility, and you can easily extract the deltas between snapshots and then transfer the deltas to another machine. There's the vulnerable rsync that I guess most of you will be familiar with. I guess I would call this the Swiss Army knife of the system administrator. Then there is you can just do a simple copy, of course. And there's things like Dropbox that make it really easy, even for your mom, to synchronize files between multiple devices. The difference between all those tools is that some of them are tied to a particular platform. So for example, Time Machine is only available on Mac. ZFS comes from the Solaris world. There are ports for Linux these days, but then again, it originally came from the Solaris world. Okay, so all of those tools all of those tools are available to use. Some of them are tied to platforms, and desync. I would position desync just as another option among the many tools that you have available to synchronize data between two machines. Okay, so let's look at two of them in more detail. I already said that rsync is sort of the Swiss Army knife of the system administrator. It works at the file system level, and it employs a couple of heuristics to actually minimize the amount of data that is transferred between two machines. It works on directory trees, so when you do an rsync of one directory and then you give it a destination, once rsync is finished, those directory trees will be identical. One way of minimizing the amount of things that are transferred is that rsync looks, for example, at the modification date of a file. If the two modification timestamps are exactly the same, it will not transfer the data. If, on the other hand, those timestamps do not match, rsync employs an algorithm that looks at the file in blocks and tries to figure out which blocks of the files have actually changed in order to minimize the amount of data that is transferred. And this is a very costly operation, because rsync does not just try to identify which blocks have changed, but it also employs an algorithm that tries to find out whether the content within the file has just shifted. Okay. So rsync's main goal is to really minimize the amount of data that is transferred, and I would say these days the trade-offs that rsync made might have shifted a bit. So these days, especially with the data sizes in the gigabytes, we are not so much worried about whether we transfer 4 kilobyte more or less, but actually we are more worried about if the process finishes in an hour or maybe in a minute. And there's a really big difference that we will see in the evaluation. Okay, and then there is desync, which has a similar name than rsync, so it, hopefully this makes people want to start using it right away. The desync relies on so we made some modifications to the Linux kernel in order to enable desync to do what it does. It is the kernel modifications are supplemented by user space tools. So there's tools to use the information that is exported from the kernel to the user space to extract differences between devices and then transfer the differences to the target device. This is also the main difference between rsync and desync, whereas rsync works on the file system, desync works on the block device level. So what we are, which makes it independent of the file system, right? So even if you do not have access to ZFS on your box, as long as you have block devices and have a recent Linux distribution, you can start using desync right away. The main example that I'm usually using when I introduce desync is that these days people have virtual machine images, which is one example of files that have that are multiple gigabytes in size. And when you have your hypervisor, you have two options how to attach the virtual machine image to the virtual machine. As you can either give it the raw block device, which then would make desync. This is the left column. So there, desync, which would sit directly on top of the block device, and then you have the desync layer, which is which works by modifying the device mapper in Linux. And then you have the virtual machine on top. If, on the other hand, your virtual machine image is just another file in your file system, then the stack looks a bit more elaborate in that you have to turn the file that represents your virtual machine image using maybe a loopback device into a block device. And then you can put the desync layer on top of that loopback device and give it to the virtual machine to actually use it. OK, so what does desync actually do? Well, the general idea is really straightforward. If you have a block device, which you can divide into distinct 4 kilobyte blocks, all that desync does is whenever you change one of those block, it will keep track of those changes. So you have one bit per 4 kilobyte block of your raw device that is kept in kernel space. So we did this by modifying the device mapper that is already present in Linux. Usually, you use the device mapper to either install a software RAID, or you can aggregate multiple physical devices into a single logical device. So there's all kinds of things that you can do with the device mapper. We modified one of those modules to do the tracking of the changes. For example, if you have to stick with the 4 terabyte drive that we had in the beginning, if you want to track all the blocks of this 4 terabyte drive, you need a bit vector that is 128 megabyte in size. Right now, the data structure is kept in memory, which is like the Achilles heel of the system, because in the current implementation there's no fault tolerance. So if the machine crashes, you have to go back to some more. You have to use an alternative approach in order to synchronize the two systems, because you lose the state that is just in memory. If you want to reduce the size of the bit vector, if you say, okay, hey, I cannot afford to have 128 megabyte wasted by this bit vector, you could also employ something like Bloom filters just in order to reduce the size of the data that you have to keep in memory. But we did not investigate this for this work. So you have this modification of the Linux kernel that does the tracking, and you export all this information as with a virtual file that sits in the proc file system. So for every device that you are tracking with desync, you get a new virtual file in the proc file system that you can just read out. Whenever you read it, you get a list of block numbers of all the blocks that have been modified since the last reset of the bit vector. And then you have tools that that you just give the name of the device, then it will start reading this virtual file from the proc file system. And while reading the file, it gets the block numbers and also extracts the blocks of the device that have changed. It outputs them to standard output. And then on the other side, you have the tool that actually takes this stream of block numbers and 4 kilobyte data blocks that have been modified and merges them into the target device, which is really nice and follows the Unix philosophy, because you can build pipelines with this. So for example, you can just do DM extract, then you give it the name, and then you can because the machine that you actually want to transfer the data to is sitting on the network. You can just pipeline the output into an SSH, and then on the other side you invoke this DM merge that merges the changes into the target device. Okay, so how did we evaluate desync? Well, we used a mix of synthetic and real-world workload traces. The synthetic workloads consist of random modifications to a block device, which is important when we get to the performance graphs because there is little spatial locality in the synthetic workloads. And then we used real-world workloads where we had a virtual machine that was running a Rubus workload. So Rubus is a web application that mimics eBay, the Rubus was written 10 years ago. The nice thing about Rubus is that it comes with a workload generator, so you have this virtual machine and then you can use the workload generator to generate traffic for that virtual machine. And here we track the modifications that happen to the virtual machine disk while the workload is running. We also use publicly available traces from Microsoft Research as the second real-world workload. When we get to the synchronization times of the different tools, the benchmark setup was like we had two machines. One was that were connected over switched gigabit Ethernet. One was the source for the data transfer, and the other one was the target. Okay, so what we are really interested, or what one of the main things that we are interested in, is how fast are those tools. So I bashed rsync in the beginning, saying, "Oh, it's really slow when you get to gigabyte-sized files." And as we can see on this graph, so here we compare five different tools. So it's not just rsync. We also have we also evaluated how long does it simply take to copy to do a one-to-one copy from the source to the target, and then we also investigated ZFS. As well as block MD5 sync, which probably needs a bit of introduction. So block MD5 sync, the problem with rsync that I said is that it also computes rolling checksums. So it does not just compute a checksum per block, but in order to identify shifted content, it also has to do rolling checksums. And this rolling checksum is actually what makes rsync so expensive in terms of CPU time. What block MD5 sync does, it just computes one checksum per 4 kilobyte block. And if the checksums match on the source and the target, it does not transfer the block. If the checksums mismatch of it, it transfers the block. So this, you can say block MD5 sync is like a lightweight rsync. Okay, so what we see is when we concentrate on the x-axis, we have different sizes of data that we want to synchronize. And on the y-axis, we have the time it takes to synchronize that data. So if we concentrate on the... Do I have a cursor? No. So if we concentrate on the 32 gigabyte, on the case where we transfer, want to synchronize 32 gigabytes, we see that rsync takes about 35 minutes to transfer a single file that has that has 32 gigabytes, which is really a lot. The other ones are pretty close with just under 10 minutes. We can actually zoom in. So this is the same data that we saw before, but we took rsync out of the picture in order to get a better view of the other ones. We see that it takes actually longer to copy everything than if we extract the differences, like for example the block MD5 sync does. So just copying 32 gigabytes from A to B takes about 6 minutes. If we are a bit more clever, like for example we use ZFS, ZFS decreases the time to synchronize by 1 minute, so ZFS in this case takes 5 minutes. Desync is just a little bit faster. No, it's a little bit slower than block MD5 sync. Right? So, okay. But, of course, looking at the raw wall clock time that it takes to synchronize all that data is not the only thing that we were interested in. So in the beginning I said, okay, we also care about resource utilization. So let's, for example, look at the CPU utilization for the different tools. What we see here is interesting. So this is the CPU utilization of the entire system measured at the source of the transfer. And if we look at rsync, we see that rsync sits, or the sender side of rsync sits idle for the first 500 seconds. So the sender During that first 500 seconds, the sender does nothing. While at the target is busy computing checksums for the file that it then sends to the source. After the destination is finished computing checksums, the sender actually starts occupying one entire core. So this was measured on a 6-core machine. So 16% CPU utilization translates into one core being 100% busy. So with rsync, we have one core that computes checksums for the remaining 1,500 seconds. Yes. If we look at the other tools, we see that the simply copying from A to B occupies one core, more or less, for the first 400 seconds. And then if we look at the CPU utilization of desync, we see that desync actually uses more CPU, but for only the first 200 seconds. And this is something that I only discovered after I submitted the paper, is that because we measure the CPU utilization of the entire box, we not just see the CPU utilization of desync, but what we did here is we used a loopback device, and it turns out that using a loopback device is actually pretty inefficient. So there is this is more or less two cores that are busy for the desync, but you can basically subtract one core because this is the CPU utilization just of the loopback device. If we would have used the raw block device for this experiment, the CPU utilization of desync would be similar to that of copy. Okay, so we can summarize that desync decreases the time it takes to synchronize, and it also saves a lot of CPU power because we do not need to compute that many checksums. If we, on the other hand, look at the network utilization, which is interesting if you transfer the data over the network from one machine to another, you see the following things. So copy achieves network utilization that is very close to what you get from a 1 gigabit NIC. So for example, the first 400 second copy transfers about 120 megabyte per second. Because this is a 32 gigabyte file, it finishes after around 400 seconds. Rsync, on the other hand, while it is really busy computing checksums, it almost uses no network bandwidth, right? So for starting from 500 seconds up to the end of the run, rsync transfers about 5 to 6 megabytes per second, which is not a lot if you consider that you had actually a 1 gigabit or gigabit available. Desync, on the other hand, in the lower left corner, it utilizes about 18 megabyte or transfers about 18 megabyte per second, which some of you might be wondering, why is that so low? The reason here is that if I do a copy, I can benefit very much from the sequential reads that I get from my disk. Whereas I said that this is measured with the synthetic benchmarks, where I modify random blocks. So the problem that desync has here is because the blocks are modified randomly, it can only read them from disk randomly. This is why the throughput that you see over the network is so low in this graph. What we also did is we modified different numbers of blocks randomly. So this is still the synthetic workloads. And this is where you see that spatial locality, no matter whether you have an HDD or SSD, is actually important. Because even though the number of blocks that we transfer increase on the x-axis, so we start with the 10% is what we saw before, and then we increase the number of randomly modified blocks. If I go to 90% randomly modified blocks out of my 8 gigabytes of data, I would expect that the time to synchronize that data actually increases because I have to transfer more things. But actually, it doesn't. We see that the graph stays flat, and this is exactly because there's more spatial locality. So I benefit from being able to read data off the disk more quickly. And this is why the time to actually synchronize stays constant. It actually goes down for desync in this case. For ZFS, it stays constant, as well as for block MD5 sync. OK, so what if we move away from synthetic traces and go to real-world traces, where we expect to see the spatial locality that we would, that is actually present in the wild. I don't know if you can read this, but the left bar, the all black one, is rsync. Again, it's like more than 2 times slower than the next competitor. next to rsync is desync, which is, I don't know how many x that is. It's like a 10x improvement over rsync, at least, I would say. The next bar is copy, which is faster than rsync. But then again, remember that copy transfers the entire 32 gigabytes over the network, so it's not really it's not really saving network bandwidth. The next one is a block MD5 sync, where we have to compute checksums, which is why it takes longer than desync. But it, of course, saves a lot of network bandwidth. And then ZFS is even a bit slower than desync. But again, the difference between, or the selling point of desync, is that not everybody can use ZFS, because it's not available on every platform. And then the other, I think, important difference between ZFS and desync is that while ZFS relies on copy on write snapshots, desync does not have that space overhead. So whenever you use ZFS to extract the delta between two snapshots, the amount of extra storage that you need is equivalent to the amount of data that changes between those two snapshots. While with desync, the overhead is basically constant. It's however many bits you need in order to keep this bit vector. Okay, to summarize, desync is just another tool in the white space of things that you can use to synchronize two copies of data between two machines. The main selling point that I want to bring across here is that it is file system agnostic, because it works on the block device level. So no matter whether you have ZFS or X3 or I don't know what file system you are using, because desync works on the block device level, it works no matter what file system is on top. Because this is engineering, you always have trade-offs. So in desync, you trade off the space that you need in order to keep this bit vector of the changes. But what you trade this for is you use less CPU, because you do not have to compute any checksums at the time you actually want to do the synchronization. And there's also a lot less disk I/O, because even if I do the copy, I have to first read all that data from disk in order to transfer it, whereas with desync, I only read the blocks that have actually changed. That's it. All the code is available on GitHub, so you can go to this URL and download the code. There's also instructions for how to compile the kernel module on a recent Ubuntu machine. And then there's a call for help. So if anybody here works for PLX technology or knows someone who works for them, I would be happy to talk to them after the talk. That's it.
I have two questions. One, how do you deal with file system consistency at the remote side? That, you know, if you're copying ZFS and it's got, ZFS is probably not a good example because it has its own consistency guarantees, but something like if you're using XFS, if you're brave enough, or EXT3, how do you just like run an FSCK on it?
So you mean if the data gets corrupted during transfer?
No, I mean, you might have stuff in memory, then you might not have a completely consistent image on the disk at the time that you're pulling things through. By the time you've pulled the blocks through, in that interval, the file system may have changed.
So it's a good question. The running example that I used was virtual machine images that you want to synchronize between two boxes. And here, the assumption is that the virtual machine is actually shut off when you do the synchronization. Okay. So if you want to do this on a live system, you might still have to use something like snapshots in order to make sure that the device is no longer updated while you do the transfer.
Right. And my second question is, if you had any graphs related to memory consumption?
No. We did not measure.
I'd expect it to be much better than rsync in that case, since it's just, rsync is sort of a memory pig.
Probably.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, we did not look at memory consumption.
All right, thank you.
So I got the point. This is obviously a lifesaver if you don't have a snapshotting file system like EXT4, EXT3, right? That's pretty much the only good way to do it. Now, you talk about ZFS. I'm on Linux. I use BetterFS. And it has the way to do snapshots and then send a snapshot diff over SSH to another machine to do exactly the same thing than that. I haven't used it because I haven't had the need for that yet. But I'm guessing ZFS does the same.
Yes.
And I just don't understand how it can be so much less efficient than what you're doing, because it knows every block by copy on write which one's changed, and it knows what to send, and it does nothing more. So it does use more storage because you do get the snapshots for free, yes, which is not what you're trying to do. By the time you send your data, how come it's so much faster with your solution?
Well, actually, if you look at the graphs, there's actually not much difference between the wall clock time that you use for the synchronization. So I have not measured anything with ButterFS. But if you see here that the bars for ZFS and desync are basically the same. Even ZFS is doing bit faster than...
I misread the colors. Sorry.
I see.
I didn't see the right bars. No, okay, I get it now. Yes. Okay, so it's effectively the same, well, close enough. But, of course, only if you have a file system that does it.
Yes. The main difference is that if you have access to ZFS, use it.
Yeah, okay, got it. So same thing on Linux, you can do that too, but if you don't have it, this is awesome. Thanks.
I wonder if it would be possible to change the granularity of your block size. Did you play around with that?
No. So this is definitely possible. It also helps with the amount of state that you have to keep in memory, obviously. So if you have larger blocks, you need fewer bits for the same amount of data. Of course, you trade on the other hand that you might have to transfer more things because the granularity just got bigger. Yeah. We did not investigate this, no. But it's definitely interesting if you want to do this.
Yeah, I think it would. And there was a graph with a SSD and throughput. This one, right.
Sorry.
And you argued that this would be random. So the low throughput for desync would be caused by random access. But on the SSD, the random access doesn't count, right?
If you actually try it, you will see that it does count.
It really does.
So this is the expectation that I had when I started this, and I was really when I saw the graphs, I was really wondering, what is going on here? So if you look at the data sheets for SSDs, they promise you 20,000, 30,000, 40,000 I/O operations per second, which you might get. So again, this is the caveat. This is only a single reader. So if you maybe have multiple readers where the SSD can somehow reorder requests, you see a higher throughput. But if you only have a single reader that does random I/O from the SSD, you will not get more than, or we did not get more than roughly 20 megabytes out
so
of
what,
this.
What SSD was this? Was this a 32 gig SSD low cost?
This is 120 gig SSD from Intel. For the exact model, you would have to look at the paper.
Okay.
It's in the paper.
I'll look in. And the last suggestion, did you ever think about integrating this into some backup software?
Not yet.
You could save the change into a forever incremental thing like Tivoli Storage Manager or so, and then you would be able to do image restores as well then at a later time.
So there's definitely potential for to continue this work. One thing my shepherd suggested is that you could also use this as a generic backups service for your mobile device. So if you have an iPhone or whatever, that you can use that to track the changes on the SSD of the iPhone device.
All right, let's thank our speakers one more time.